You are listening to a program created at Meridian University. This conversation is a part of Meridian University's virtual summit on transformative learning. Thank you for your interest in this program. For more information about Meridian University's programs, please visit us at meridianuniversity.edu. Thank you.
Welcome back, everyone. We are in the second day of our four-day summit on Reimagining Learning, a virtual summit on transformative learning. I'm Courtney Lubell, and I'm the Associate Director of the Center for Transformative Learning at Meridian University. We have almost 1,000 participants from around the world participating in this inquiry together, and it has been rich and deep and exciting to dialogue together around this topic. We really encourage participants to ask their questions and continue to be a part of the conversation. If you're listening in via the telephone, you can press star 2. And if you're listening in via the webcast, you can ask questions by entering your question in the bottom left-hand corner of the submission box in your webcast window. We're also in conversation on the summit's Facebook page, and we invite you to ask questions and make comments about your experience of the summit throughout the next 2 days together. You can also access the summit's Facebook page by clicking on the Facebook icon located on the top left corner of the email you received with today's schedule. And if you're listening in via the webcast, you can access the Facebook page on the webcast access page in the bottom left-hand corner. I'm excited that we're ending our second day of the summit with Terry Patton, who is going to be talking with us about transformative learning as a spiritual practice. Terry Patton hosts the popular online teleseminar series called Beyond Awakening, The Future of Spiritual Practice. He teaches the acclaimed 8-session course, Integral Spiritual Practice. He co-authored with Ken Wilber the best-selling book, Integral Life Practice, and his upcoming or forthcoming book is called The Integral Revolution. So we're so excited to have Terry here. And he will be in conversation today with Meridian University's president, Aftab Omer. Over to you, Aftab.
Thanks, Courtney. And Terry, welcome to the summit.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to this conversation with you. Terry,
yeah,
could we begin with some of your own journey as a transformative learner?
Well, I'm actually in a very sweet moment right now. My whole life was changed by a transformative learning experience that took place almost 40 years ago when I was a resident fellow at Cold Mountain Institute, which was the Canadian Growth Center, very similar to Esalen. And I went there. Life had opened me up. I was frustrated with the limits of the University of Michigan, where I went to college, and I left. The professors there obviously didn't understand the meaning of life and were struggling in their own lives. And I was turned on to this program, and I lived there for 3 months and immersed myself. And for the first time, I learned yoga and tai chi and meditation and entered into encounter groups and experienced transformative learning. And out of that, I realized that I needed to find a teacher, because the things that I cared about in life required a profound change in my consciousness, even beyond what I'd already encountered. So I found my way to an ashram and a great spiritual teacher. I spent 15 years apprenticed to that, and then I kind of self-graduated from the ashram. And during the next 10 years, I wrote a book with my wife, and we founded a company and sold tools for, we called them consciousness technologies, for mind-body connections and opening to deeper self-awareness, things like home EEG machines and a variety of other tools. We had over about 1,000 different products in our catalog. Then I sold that company. That was a transformative learning experience in itself, I have to say. Being an entrepreneur is quite intense. And then out of that, after writing a book, I joined with Ken Wilber and a core group at Integral Institute to design and create a different approach to transformative learning, which we called Integral Life Practice. And that's the book I co-wrote with Ken and two younger colleagues. And I've been devoted to refining that approach, which is an approach. It includes spiritual practice, that it has a strong meditative component, but it also involves body practices, mental practices, shadow practices, dealing with our psychological issues, and practices in relationship, because the fixities in the being that are broken up through one of these kinds of practices are powerfully synergistic with when you break them up, that opening up of the being creates a synergistic effect with others. For instance, if somebody meditates and takes up weightlifting at the same time, they actually progress faster in their meditation than if they only meditated, even with the same teacher and the same amount of practice and the same native talent. The other kinds of practices open us. So the synergies among these different kinds of practice and learning are the core of the idea of integral life practice. And I've continued to refine that in the 7 or 8 years since we began that process, and I've now begun to teach a course we call Integral Spiritual Practice that takes it even further. So there's my story in kind of a nutshell.
You did that in 2 minutes in a very effective way. So when you look at the consciousness conversation right now, and we hear the terms transformation and we hear the term evolution. In your work, do you specifically differentiate in how these terms are used?
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I use them kind of interchangeably. When I distinguish them, transformation, well, I guess transformation might be a more general term that I would use to refer to any kind of learning or growth in which the who I am goes through a change. That is, the person who begins the learning process is changed in the process, so that something about my understanding of myself, my way of being myself, my capacities, my center of gravity, my values, my way of making meaning, my identity has shifted. When I talk about evolution, I'm usually talking more specifically about one of two kinds of change, one of them being the kind of transformation that takes place when we liberate latent capacities and what was invisible to us because it was the lens through which we were operating. That is, if I am only able to see the world through a certain lens, I don't see the lens itself. I can't look at the lens because I'm only looking through it. But at a certain point in the process, you begin to become aware of that lens. And then when you look at the lens and you then look both through it and at it, and you can implicitly imagine what it is to subtract that lens or to substitute a different lens. That involves an emergence into a whole new panorama of reality, a whole different dimension of existence becomes visible. So I sometimes am referring to that when I talk about evolution and evolution of consciousness through stages in which subject becomes object again and again and again more deeply. And then sometimes I use the word evolution to refer to the liberation of latent capacities. You know, our human body minds are so incredibly sensitive. We have such rich capacities. There are all these meridians and chakras and higher brain centers, which reflect capacities that don't fully come online in most human beings. Really, all of them almost never come fully online. The most evolved, awakened saints and sages and enlightened beings reflect the capacities of the human body mind that are really extraordinary. And so there's an evolution when we get out of the way of some of those capacities and let them come online. So sometimes I'm talking about that. And then there's another kind of evolution, which is the fact that we are all alive right now in a time in which culture itself is transforming, in which the process of all of us together as a human species learning and growing is accelerating. We're in a crisis time in which in our lifetimes human beings will have to find new ways of making decisions and meeting our challenges, in which we're able to cooperate and operate on the basis of a consciousness beyond that which we are already operating at. And so sometimes we can come alive enough that we can participate in that process of cultural evolution, of collective learning, in which the human species itself is reinventing itself. And that is the cutting edge for all of us. And I think that many of us feel a calling to participate in this process of the whole human species becoming more conscious and capable and healthy and meeting these challenges of our time in a truly healthy way. And we're willing to be transformed in service of that. And so that is another meaning of the word evolution when I use it.
Well, that's clarifying. So much of the context in which spirituality is the focus, there is actually very little, if any, transformative learning taking place. In fact, to the contrary, people are involved in confirming their beliefs. Your work within the domain of spiritual practice is the opposite of that. Can you speak about that difference in spiritual practice that is, in fact, transformative learning and when it isn't?
Mm. Well, I think what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, Aftab, I'd like to put a little bit of a spin on that and say that for learning to be transformational, we actually have to be willing to change. And the fact of the matter is we are conditioned by our common cultural experience toward defensiveness and closure. And to the degree that we are defensive and closed, we are unable to participate in any kind of transformative learning. Transformative learning, by its nature, asks us to become uncomfortable. It asks us to get outside the familiar, the zone of familiar pattern and habit. And we have to let go of the things that we have held on to when we have been threatened or attacked. And to the degree that we're feeling threatened or attacked, to the degree that we feel like there might be something wrong with us, to the degree that we are feeling that, that someone might be suggesting that there's something wrong with us, that we might be invalidated, to the degree we're feeling insecure, it's very, very hard for us to open. It feels as if we'll just be made more vulnerable and we'll be hurt. But if you can get enough basic health, enough confidence, enough self-security, enough feeling of connection to yourself and care for yourself and love for yourself, be your friend enough that you have enough confidence and security that you can open up and enter into the discomfort of letting go of your familiar ways of being with a sense of possibility and a sense of hope, that there's another way of being that will come to you, that letting go of your old way of being is a thought experiment, an inquiry, and that it's a way of going fishing for new capacities and new possibilities, and that something real and beautiful and true and good will possibly happen. And that if it doesn't, you'll still learn something and you'll be able to go back to your old ways of being. So as soon as we have that attitude, then we can participate in transformative learning. Now, if we get the point, not only that that is a possibility, but that that is such a richer way of relating to our experience, that it could be our way of life, that in fact, that every moment of life is an opportunity either to rehearse some past way of being or to open into a new possibility. If we catch sight of that opportunity and our hearts can open and embrace that and feel that sense of possibility, a sense of beginner's mind, the Zen teachers call it, in which, you know, I don't know, but maybe, you know, something good could happen, a kind of sense of curiosity and adventure. If we can relate to it like that, then all kinds of vistas open up, and we can begin to discover that life itself, every moment of life, this moment, like right now talking to you, I am speaking about things that I talk about a lot, but if I simply say phrases and words that I've said before, if I simply rehearse it, if I turn this into a performance, well, it might be a good performance, but there will be a lack of a certain kind of contact, because what's more interesting is if I imagine the people who are listening, and I'm imagining you off top, and I'm imagining Courtney, I'm imagining everyone who's listening right now, and feeling toward, well, how can I speak to you, and what is it like for you, and if there's some part of me alive in that exchange, you can feel me in that exchange, and then I'm exercising something authentic and alive in this moment, then I'm learning, and I'm not just saying stuff I've said before. I'm engaging in a real act of communication and an act of learning, and I'm opening to a greater presence. So it's a spiritual practice for me to do this interview, because if I'm lucky, the one who finishes the interview will be a little different from the one who began, because I'll have changed in the process. If I'm lucky, a greater power will meet my willingness, my beginner's mind, and something bigger than me will flow through me and ennoble me and enlighten me and maybe someone else. And maybe what I will have done will have been of service to something greater than myself. And I will have been used by that greater power. And if I open right now in that spirit, then all of us get more of a chance to participate in that spirit, and then this whole occasion becomes more of a transformational moment for all of us. And there's so much spirit in that. That's a practice. And so that attitude that I'm trying to take toward this moment is an attitude that I try to teach people to take toward every moment of life. And that's not always done the same way. It's an art. It's not a formula. It has to be discovered and enacted. And we'll tend, even when, once we learn it, we'll tend to rehearse it and do it in the same old way and turn it into habit and turn it into formula and take it for granted. And then it'll have to be broken open and come alive again. And the willingness to be alive, to be new, to be reborn again into that possibility, that attitude is the practice that I try to teach in my online course on integral spiritual practice and in all my own work.
As you speak, I'm feeling your practice of willingness and openness and vulnerability. And it leads me to reflect on the kinds of conversations that our culture feeds on, including on TV, where the conversation is two heads asserting beliefs and very different from what you're speaking about. And in so many contexts, spiritual contexts, the dynamic of in spiritual communities so often actually leads to a shutting down of the openness, the willingness, the vulnerability, all the prerequisites for transformative learning, as you've emphasized. And I am wondering about your experience with that and what your learnings have been in working with that.
Well, you know, I think that in order for us to grow, we need structure and we need room for improvisation. And what I try to provide for my students in my work is a series of structures, like I call it a morning practice, but you could do it any time of day. Basically a period of 20 minutes to an hour that you spend partly in stillness and partly in movement, first usually in movement and then in stillness. And so that's a period of practice that's formal. But then I also suggest that there be a practice in random moments throughout the day, that every moment, any moment, can be a moment of practice. And then I teach specific practices that have to do with reconnecting with the heart or awakening the clarity of unconditioned consciousness and freedom, or that have to do with moving into action, and usually in service. And we kind of cultivate this practice in random moments all the time. And then I also talk about mission and really getting in touch with a purpose that is larger than yourself and in your own unique way of contributing to that larger purpose. And then the specific projects, the milestones through which you can embody that. And usually we need projects through which to give our gifts. And then I also talk about maintaining the momentum of our practice by doing other practices all the time, by engaging in the sphere of the mind and sharpening our understanding, or engaging in the sphere of the body and exercising in various ways. Physically, even the subtle exercises like martial arts and qigong and stuff, all the realms of exercise and diet and the whole body realm, that whole sphere. And then there's also the psychosphere, where we do our shadow work and our soul work, our deep psychological growth. There's the realm of spirit, where we do our spiritual practice, meditation, and our devotional practice, and the relational world, where we do our intimate practice with those we're really closest to in our family and our primary intimacies, and also the civic domain, where we do our work. That's an important public domain, and then our responsibilities as members of our local and regional and national and global communities, which need our service too. And so all of those areas of our lives are places where we can practice, and we make it a practice if we work from a place of bringing the knowledge we have, but then opening with curiosity into what we do not yet know, and what may be even beyond what can be known, into the mystery itself. And so I have found that it's possible to have a deep and rich conversation about these things and to engage in a powerful way in person, but that you can also do that through virtual media, you know, online and through conversations such as the one we're having right now, audio, and that if we bring our hearts sincerely and we are open to meeting one another, we're able to convene communities of learning and practice that transcend so many boundaries, such that some of the circles I sit in have people from 5 or 6 continents. I mean, it's ridiculous how much diversity can come to bear in the experience of a group of people, and yet we can be so close, because the human spirit is universal, and when we're courageous enough and we become vulnerable, and if we're really holding with respect our own vulnerability, we can hold the vulnerability of one another with similar respect, and we can become very intimate. And that intimacy brings forward so much more courage and so much more creativity than is otherwise possible. I'm not sure if I answered your question directly, but I hope that was useful.
Very much so. And staying a little longer on this theme, Terry, that the vulnerability and the intimacy brings the sangha, the context of the spiritual practice, into some difficult straits. And if we look at the history of spiritual communities in the last 30 years, where there was quite a bit of emphasis on practices and structure and the things you've emphasized, and even so, that events happen that splinter groups, people never talk to each other again. So there's this. Perhaps we could use the metaphor of thin ice, that transformative learning itself, and focusing now on spiritual context, brings the Sangha onto some thin ice, it appears. And the ice breaks on many occasions. And I'm wondering about your reflections on that, because I hear.
Well, yes. Yeah, that's thank you. I mean, that's very authentic and important. One of the things that it's important, you know, what tends not to be said and needs to be said is that the whole world is, in a way, a cult of numbness. And there is a lie kind of implicit in the attitude set of all our public media, in which the invulnerability, the lack of ability to feel, is treated as if it's a baseline. And then if somebody's drawn into something where they become vulnerable and they become tender and they become more alive, then maybe they're going to be hurt. But if they just stayed numb, of course, then they wouldn't have been hurt. Well, your numbness is an awful form of suffering. And the opportunity to open up out of it, yes, it is very tender, and it is potentially dangerous and difficult in certain respects. But you've got a sure thing if you don't, a sure thing of remaining kind of numb and flat and unchallenged. Now, as soon as we begin to dare to hope to really be seen and met and loved and valued and received and to have intimacy and to connect with other people, it raises incredible hopes. And we want to believe, like in the honeymoon phase of a relationship, that we've found the right people and that everything's going to be different from now on, and we're just so inspired and we're so excited, and we just, you know, And then if it doesn't really meet all those hopes, we can feel very hurt because we dared to hope. And if we haven't learned a way to make sense of our experience, we can feel, oh, that was terrible. It raised my hopes and then it dashed them. I would rather have stayed numb. Well, I don't think so. I think that if you have the help of enough guidance so that you can really honor the nobility and courage and beauty of daring to be tender and to be felt and to be seen in your in the incredible vulnerability and it's so difficult to be any human being, and everybody has a story that'll break your heart if you really take it in. And if we can dare to let down our guard and see each other like that and be seen like that and enter into that kind of contact with one another, I mean, that's so much more rich and alive than the kind of robotic, defended, how are you, fine, no contact kind of common society of numbness. That's so worth it. That the thin ice, of course it's thin ice. If we dare to be alive, we're on thin ice. But where were we before? We were frozen solid. So I think that, you know, it is important as transformative educators that we create as many safeguards as we can and that we really honor the tremendous vulnerability that people bring into these circumstances. There's no question about it. But life is dangerous. And, you know, if you love, you're going to be hurt. And if you dare, you're going to sometimes have discomfort and pain. And that's not something we should be guaranteeing people they won't experience in a transformational learning environment. There should be a real adventure. We should be vulnerable and daring, and something should be possible to happen. And I think if we have agreements that honor and value that vulnerability, we're in a much healthier position than if we try to make it go away.
Thank you, Terry. Courtney has signaled me that we have questions waiting. So, Courtney, over to you.
Thank you, Aftab, and thank you, Terry. I'll start with some questions that are coming in via the webcast. I encourage those of you who are listening in via the telephone, if you have a question, you can press star 2 and ask your question live. But I'll proceed to ask Terry the questions that are coming in from those listening in via webcast. I have a question from David Elliott in Sacramento. His question is, do you have hope for or experience of the sowing and growing of the integrative spirituality within traditional theistic Western religious institutions, such as the Roman Catholic Church, perhaps related to the mystical practices within the tradition?
I do. There are some wonderful things going on in the Roman Catholic Church specifically and in other churches. I think that it's the wonderful thing about this spirit of authentic, integrative spirituality and practice is that it's the living, it's the green shoots, you know, that force their way through the cracks in the sidewalk. I think that mostly the official institutions and certainly the Roman Catholic Church, you know, tends to be the blocks of concrete that that are hard to grow through. But there are cracks everywhere. And so I know some wonderful people. One of my dearest friends is a Jesuit priest, David McCallum, who's bringing a rich spiritual disposition, but also he's at Lemoyne University doing transformative learning. There's wonderful things going on among Catholic sisters. There's a whole group of them meeting with Barbara Marx Hubbard regularly, bringing evolutionary spirituality into the Catholic Church. So there's green shoots everywhere you look, and there are opportunities for all of those things to be more fully liberated, probably, as the institutions become more permeable. So I don't think they've realized all their potentials yet, but there's certainly a lot to celebrate.
Thank you, Terry. We'll go to the next one from Vicky in Ojai, California. Her question is, when you feel threatened, it's hard to let go of defensive strategies. What do you recommend doing to support surrender?
Yeah, well, I think that it's a big part of our practice all the time and very much a part of our practice, not just when we're threatened, but when we're not specifically threatened, to build our respect for our whole experience. We have to be able to hold our fear and our sense of threat with a lot of compassion, with a lot of, like, to be a really tender friend to ourselves, to not make ourselves wrong for being threatened, to not just feel like a victim. Like, when we feel threatened, we easily feel victimized, and it's very important to break out of that, because as a victim, all the power lies outside yourself. You need to recover an awareness of your own choices and your own power. And as you do that, you know, that takes what I call masculine self-compassion. That is the inner toughness to reorient your attention from that weaker kind of stance. And then it takes feminine self-compassion, that which is just that tenderness and that respect and that honoring for your experience, where you don't make yourself wrong for feeling threatened. You don't make yourself wrong for all of that. You hold yourself in that. And so there's a process of building these inner muscles that enable you to be with yourself more thoroughly, so that sense of being threatened doesn't totally overwhelm you, so that you can hold it. You can have that experience instead of it having you. And the more that you can have that experience, then there's some free attention left over. And then you can be able, even, you know, I may be afraid, but I think I can maybe handle this. And you can kind of bring some courage. You build capacity. And I think it's something that you have to do throughout your whole life. And then in some of those moments when you're feeling threatened, whereas before you would have just been freaked out, you discover you've got some free attention and you can actually take some risks and endure some discomfort and be much more alive. I hope that's helpful.
I know that I found it helpful. And I think we may have time for just two more questions. And so appreciate the questions coming in. We have a question from Philip in Reno, Nevada. And his question is, my experience is that spirituality often turns away from the shadow. How do you see working with the shadow as a spiritual practice?
Yeah, I think that many forms of spirituality do tend to turn away from shadow. It's, you know, as we understand it today, shadow is a insight of postmodern times. You know, it really is a term coined by Jung, but it's based on the insight of Freud that when an emotion or drive or inner experience is so threatening that we kind of can't tolerate it, we exclude it. We drive it into the unconscious. We lose touch with parts of our experience, and then they operate outside our awareness and have agendas different from our own. And the great spiritual traditions all evolved in a pre-modern world where we didn't have that kind of sophisticated self-awareness. So there wasn't awareness of this process of repression into the unconscious and the creation of the shadow. So the traditional spiritual approaches are different. But more and more spiritual practitioners and spiritual teachers have a lot of psychological sophistication. And we recognize that there are different domains of work that go on simultaneously. And we can bring an attitude like that I've been describing to all of them. So there can be a kind of relaxed openness and warmth and curiosity that we bring to our exploration of our own shadow and to our exploration of spirit. You know, this whole idea of cross-training, of doing practice in these different spheres of our lives simultaneously is the whole point here. And I will have more resources, and I will know that I can feel okay even if I face my demons, if I have a stronger connection to the beloved, to spirit, to the I am-ness of my own being. So my spiritual practice can strengthen my capacity to face shadow as long as I don't use it as a substitute, as a way to bypass my shadow work. It only enhances it. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you. Well, there's a related question, and I think this will be the only last one that I can take from participants, and it's from a Martha in Knoxville, Tennessee. And her question is how do you work with negative transference or negative feelings?
When she says transference, then I think she's a therapist or a professional, and she's talking about how do I work with it from my students or clients?
I can only assume, since I don't have that additional information, but I think that's a good tactic to take.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that, you know, what I find is, as a spiritual teacher, very often I'm in the enviable position of dealing with positive transference more often than negative. But one of the things that I have learned is that the positive transference, the idealization will turn to negative, the positive will turn to negative in time if you indulge it. And the negative is always really uncomfortable and difficult. So if you're dealing with negative transference, you have to, a lot of what you have to look at is how that got generated. And sometimes there are things that you need to do at the very outset of a relationship in order to make sure that there's an understanding that you as a therapist or a coach or a teacher have, that you're entering into a mutual relationship, and that even if you're in the professional category and you're being paid for your services, you're still a human being, and that there is a requirement for some self-responsibility on both sides. So certainly with my coaching clients, you know, I have a written agreement that I establish at the beginning of the relationship so that some of these things are made explicit and everybody reads them and signs them. And that, to some degree, can create a context where then later, if there's negative transference going on, I can really be curious about the client's experience, and I don't have to take it on. I think the biggest thing is when we feel threatened by the transference, we become defensive, and then we're caught in a drama triangle in which we begin to experience the client and their transference as a persecutor. We feel like a victim. We want to rescue ourselves, and pretty much we're off to the races there. So liberating myself from it so that I can really be present to and curious and helping the client discover what they need to learn, and I try not to let my reaction to the negative transference dull my awareness of the growth opportunity that is in this for the client. And if I can stay tuned into that, then generally I find my way through it pretty well. I'm not sure that I've answered your specific situation, and if I haven't, you know, I'm sorry, but I hope what I've said is of some help.
Thank you, Terry, and back over to you, Off-Top.
Terry, I have a closing question. It's clear from the way you've spoken in this conversation how much learning from moment to moment and the openness that that requires is important to you, and your responses have not been formulaic. And so it makes me curious about where the edge of your own learning, your own work is right now, and make that our closing.
Okay. Well, there are a couple of different edges for me. One of them is a little bit more circumstantial. I've gotten a lot busier than I ever was before, and finding a way to work with that, the demands on my time and attention, is a whole new, it's at a whole new level for me, and that's been tricky. But I think that in at the heart, the thing that is the most important right now, and the thing that's really the edge for me, is bringing real courage and bringing, in a sense, having more and more faith in this present moment, more and more faith in myself, and more faith in life with a capital L, that if I enter undefended into this moment with curiosity and openness and creativity, that it will yield something more beautiful than whatever I might have planned to strategically extract from it. And therefore, letting myself relax and open and in this more trusting place, be in the moment in a more dynamic and so spontaneous and experimental dance with life, and therefore really tasting a deeper embrace and letting life surprise me and being surprised by what happens and what I say and what I learn, so that I think there's a greater degree of trust and spontaneity, allowing aspects of me, playful and kind of creative and unusual and wild and just very different aspects of my own being, to come online and in a freer and less contrived way, just kind of letting it all hang out and knowing that it's going to be okay.
The present moment is a true friend, and more and more of us are finding our way to that truth. Thanks for the work you do, and I'm very glad, Terry, that your voice can be heard in the transformative learning conversation. Thank you for this.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure, Aftab. And Courtney.
Thank you, Terry.
Back to you.
And thank you, Aftab. And Terry, as the closing speaker of today, of the second day of the summit, I just want to say that it's been a real privilege to feel the presence of your words as you speak about spiritual practice, as you show up for the questions that were asked, and as you provide to each of us that are listening a sense of both hope and turning towards the necessity arising in the present moment. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for saying so.
So I want to thank everyone for coming, and we're have a fine way to end our second day of the summit on Reimagining Learning, a virtual summit on transformative learning. This four-day summit is intended to begin a conversation for the upcoming 10th International Conference on Transformative Learning that Meridian is hosting on November 1st through 4th, 2012 in San Francisco. And this has been a very rich experience for all of us. Tomorrow morning, we're going to be coming back. Our first conversation is actually a pre-recorded conversation with Alexis Kokos on aesthetic experience as transformative learning praxis. And then we will again be back live at 10 a.m. with Elizabeth Castle. Thank you, everyone, for coming, and I look forward to continuing to deepen the inquiry together. You can continue to ask your questions on the summit's Facebook page, and appreciate everyone's collaborative interest in the subject on reimagining learning. Thank you, everyone. Goodbye.